Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einem Audiobeitrag der Open Faith HLT Community. Wir sind für mehr Offenheit, Authentizität und Unvoreingenommenheit in der Gesprächskultur der Kirche. Obwohl wir einen offenen Dialog auch über schwierige Themen befürworten, haben wir Achtung vor der eigenen religiösen Tradition. Wir hoffen, dass dies zu mehr Verständnis führt und damit zu Akzeptanz und Heilung unter unterschiedlich denkenden Mitgliedern. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Besuche unsere Webseite unter www.openfaith.de und empfehle sie gerne deinen Freunden, wenn du meinst, das kann hilfreich sein. Außerdem laden wir dich ein, Teil unserer Facebook-Community zu werden.
About the challenges of modern Mormonism, and
then we're going to have about a 15-minute Q&A. John. Thank you. Well, I have to begin by thanking Sunstone for this wonderful event. I've been following Sunstone for over a decade, and I can't tell you how thrilled I am to see Sunstone coming to Europe. I guess I shouldn't touch it. This is such an amazing site. So thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Sunstone. Thank you, Community of Christ, for inviting me here. And thanks to all of you who have supported Mormon Stories over the years, who have encouraged me. There's so many people here in the audience that I have so many fond memories of and am so grateful for. And many of you that I've never met that I've started to meet. But this is just a real honor. And it's an honor for many reasons, but one of the reasons it's an honor is because my ancestors come from England. So some of you may have noticed my middle name, Parkinson, that you see on Facebook. That comes from my great-grandfather, William Brigham Parkinson, who was born here in Bradford, Yorkshire, England. Is that where you live?
About 5 minutes away.
Yeah? Well, that's where my great-grandfather's from. He was born in 1852. Interestingly enough, he converted along with his grandfather and father. So the day he was baptized in the church, he was already a third generation Mormon in 1852. He emigrated here to the United States. His mother died on the way. Later, his father died, and he ended up being raised partly by a stepmother in Oregon. But he ran away from her at age 12, eventually making it to Utah. Really industrious guy. He worked as a telegraph operator, a storekeeper. He came back to England to serve a mission, became a doctor, and he set up practice in Logan, which is where I live now. Interestingly enough, I was raised in Texas, which is a state in the United States. But I ended up moving back to Cache Valley because I wanted to do this work, and I wanted to do it out of Utah. This is a picture of my great-grandfather William with his horse and buggy outside of the Pioneer Drugstore in downtown Logan. He was really proud to have that horse and buggy. Interestingly, he was also one of the first citizens of Logan to actually have an automobile. So this is my great-grandfather Parkinson, standing in front of that automobile. My last name, DeLynn, actually comes from Sweden, and I haven't been able to actually trace the origins of that name, but I'm obviously very European, and it's really heartwarming for me to be back here, sort of in the place of my ancestry. So this is a picture of my great-grandfather William with his wife, Edith. And if you look over to the left, there's a one of eight children. Her name is Karma. And Karma is my grandmother. This is Karma as an older woman married to Bernice. And they have six children. Some of them are still alive. And in the bottom left is my mother, Nan, who was the fifth of six children. This is my grandmother as I knew her, Karma. She's a cousin of Ezra Chap Benson. And this is my mom and dad when they first met in the 50s. He looks like Elvis a little bit. And then that's me as a baby. And then this is us as young kids. This is my family. So my dad's on the left, my mom's on the right. And then there's four children, and I'm the youngest of four. That's me in the bottom right. And then this is our family as we were a little bit older. And so again, that's me looking like John Travolta or someone out of the 70s, back when disco was really big. And I love looking at these pictures because I'm trying to connect a bit more with my heritage. But I also just think so fondly back to my upbringing in the church. Even though I was raised in Texas, Mormonism is what defined our family. It's what defined my identity. I have so many incredibly happy memories. This is me participating in like a Boy Scout decathlon where so many happy memories in Boy Scouts, which was obviously affiliated with the church. This is a high school dance that I went to with my friend, going through memory. This is a picture of me on my mission. I served a mission in Guatemala. And one of my favorite pictures from my mission is that one. I don't know why, but I just thought it'd be funny to get a picture with an AK-47 in my hand. So I went up to some Guatemalan soldiers and said, "Hey, can I take a picture of you and hold your rifle?" So there it is. Maybe my second favorite picture is this one. This is me as a sophomore at BYU. I was a RA in the dorms, and it was homecoming. And there were several girls in the dorms that did not get asked to homecoming. And so I had this crazy idea, and Lindsay's going to love this. I had this crazy idea to rent a 12-person passenger van and to ask all the girls who didn't get asked to homecoming to go with me to homecoming. So there's a picture of me and about eight other girls. It's a very Mormon picture, isn't it? Let's shake your head. Why are you shaking your head? We had a ball. It was really fun. But I have so many happy memories as a Mormon. Primary, choirs, dances, scripture chase, seminary, youth conferences, temple trips, testimony meetings, dance festivals, road shows, missionary service. My heart is full with gratitude for my upbringing. It's really weird to be excommunicated, especially living in Utah, because everybody thinks of you as evil. Like, everyone I talk to is like, my parents, like, I can't like you, I can't friend you on Facebook because my parents think you're evil. And, you know, they think you're evil because they think you hate the church. I don't hate the church. I've never hated the church. I love this church. I love this tradition. It has brought me so much happiness, and I think many of you will relate. If I've struggled with this tradition, it's because I love it so much, not because, not because I hate it. I want it to be all I thought it was. I want it to be everything it can be. And so that's sort of what's always motivated me. But all these beautiful memories start right there in that sacred grove when that young boy had some questions, had some doubts. He had some fears and concerns about what's going to happen to his brother Alvin who died. What's going to happen if his, you know, if his father isn't sort of a member of some religious tradition? Are they all going to get to go to heaven, right? And so these genuine concerns, born out of love and born out of true concern about loving family members, caused him to go to a grove of trees and to pray and to seek help and support. And so this beautiful legacy has been born out of this young man seeking truth and seeking wisdom and having the courage to ask questions. And I'll just sort of give a disclaimer that I come out of the LDS church tradition, so I'm going to be speaking a lot about that. But I've also grown to really love Community of Christ. And so I'll be trying to weave that in a little bit here today. But for those of you from Community of Christ tradition, please forgive me if I speak sort of from a Utah-centered point of view. It's just the paradigm from which I come. But if you think about the legacy of the Restoration, we have chapels and temples that dot the globe. All over the world, our influence is felt in every major city. We are the most successful American-born religious tradition in the world. We have reached global prominence in 170 years' time. We're on par with Judaism in terms of total membership. Think about that. They've been around for about 3 millennia, and we kind of caught up to them in terms of numbers in about 170 years. There's so many incredible organizations. We have several major universities that we run. We produce world-class businessmen and thinkers and artists and entertainers and athletes and politicians. I haven't even told you about the best part of our Restoration tradition. And it's the people. Now, I'm no longer of the mindset that we're better than everybody else in the world. Having said that, I'm extremely proud to be of my people. I think that our people, and I think this counts for both, you know, both traditions that are sort of represented here today, we have produced a group of people, communities of people, that are committed to families, that are committed to hard work, to integrity, to community, to creativity, to resilience. We have faith communities all over the world that are functioning so well. And we really understand community and service and support. And one of the things I'm most grateful for, probably of all things of my upbringing, are the values that I carry having been raised in this tradition. Values like courage and service, and of love and acceptance. And these values are really well enshrouded in some of the primary songs that I learned as a kid. Have any of you ever learned this song, Dare to Do Right? Let's sing it. Is that all right? You guys want to sing the first verse with me? Because this song really captures sort of the courage that has inspired me throughout my life. You guys ready? All right, let's do it. Dare to do right. Dare to be true. You have a work that no other can do. Do it so bravely, so kind, so well. Angels will hasten the story to tell. Dare, dare, dare to do right. Dare, dare, dare to be true. Dare to be true. Dare to be true. Is that beautiful? The hair standing up on my arms. Those songs live with me. Here's another one. You guys remember Give Seth the Little Stream? Give Seth the Little Stream. Give a gift, give a gift. Give Seth the Little Stream as he hurried down the hill. I'm small, I know, but wherever I go, the grass grows green. Singing, singing all the day, give away, oh, give away. Singing, singing all the day, give away, give away. Beautiful, that was really good. Yeah. Don't we carry that value of service with us? Where we're always trying to do good and to serve. That value has not left me. And I have a sense that even for those of you who may not still be attending church, I have a sense that that value hasn't left you either. Probably my favorite primary song was written by Carolyn Pearson. And I don't know how many of you grew up singing this song. I don't even know that this song was popular when I was growing up. But I'll tell you that this is probably the hymn that captures, the primary song that captures what I think is one of the most beautiful values of Mormonism. It goes kind of like this. If you don't walk as most people do, some people walk away from you, but I won't. If you don't talk as most people do, some people talk and laugh at you, but I won't. I'll walk with you, I'll talk with you, that's how I'll show my love for you. And those hymns still get me choked up. But I'm proud to be a Mormon. Still, I'm proud to come from this religious tradition. I'm proud of my people, and I'm proud of the organizations that have carried the restoration to 2016. And even though I've been excommunicated from this church, that hasn't changed, and it's not going to change. There's so much that I'm proud of. And so it's difficult to be asked to talk about the challenges of modern Mormonism, because I don't want to be negative. I'm not ever about trying to tear anything down or hurt the church. But there are real challenges. We are facing real significant challenges right now. And I'm about to talk about some really heavy stuff. Some stuff that can really get you down. Because I think we really are at a challenging place. And both religious traditions. I was speaking to Communion of Christ people last night. And they're facing real challenges too. And so what I did is I put out a little call to, you know, listeners to just sort of give me a summary. And right now I'm just going to pull from the UK, from Europe. There's a reason why I think Europe is really important to talk about. So somebody wrote that in the UK, they've lost about 30 congregations net in the past 10 years. That there have been no new stakes in the last 10 years in the United Kingdom. And I actually went to a website to see that, and it's true. The UK has had 45 stakes since 2005. So for 11 years, the United Kingdom has not added a stake, according to the numbers that we've seen. Baptisms have fallen. The recent missionary surge has had pretty much no impact. So you double the missionaries, no increase in baptisms. That's crazy, right? And the total membership in the UK is actually declining. So the church is actually, the LDS church is actually in decline in the United Kingdom. Someone wrote, back home in England, all I can see right now is stagnation. Baptisms have dropped in our ward and retention is low. The same members are serving the same callings time and again, and I sense a level of frustration and tiredness among some members. Not many of my friends growing up served missions, and most were less active by the time they went to university. What's happening now, though, is different. It's easy to be colored by the faith crisis epidemic in the church when you're dealing with the issue firsthand. But I believe most wards are finding some returned missionaries in the 20, 25 to 35 age bracket who aren't staying. I was not aware of this happening at all growing up in the 80s and 90s. Church history and culture are the main issues. People here are much more liberal than in the United States. And issues like same-sex marriage cause a lot of cognitive dissonance, as there's widespread support for it amongst 40-year-olds and younger, even in the church. The issue with church history is really shocking people, as until the internet, the only materials available were church-produced correlated materials. There's no Deseret Book here, and until recently, getting deep church history books from publishers like Signature Books, who are here in force today, I'm glad to see, was impossible. Someone else wrote, I was a member of Britannia Ward. And this is a really interesting thing. There happens to be a ward here that's leading all of Europe in baptisms. That's kind of exciting, right? Well, here's kind of how they're doing it. I was a member of Britannia Ward, the YSA Ward in the Hyde Park Stake. The stake Alan Phillips, son of Tom Phillips, who some of you have heard of, is stake president in, which, if the people involved in the ward and the mission would be believed, is the highest baptizing mission award in all of the UK and possibly England. The reason for the success seems to be from a large push to teach Chinese students from many of the different universities in London. The missionaries in the ward basically stand on Exhibition Road, so it's near the museums, and tract. Imperial College is on the same road with many international, mainly Chinese students. There's been a big push to convert these students, and there is now enough separate Chinese Sunday school and institute classes. I think I saw less than 10 non-Chinese baptisms as a member of the ward before leaving the church. A few of these were poor Eastern Europeans. Of Anglophones, I saw 4 baptisms, one of them being myself. And this person since left the church. And so what this is getting across, and I've seen this in every European country that wrote in, if there's any missionary success, who is it with? Yeah, immigrants from developing countries. And that is the lifeblood of the church. Italy. I've seen Italy bloom from 1 mission to 4 in a short amount of time, but they're down to 2 after Padova and Catania closed and will likely be down to just 1 again. Germany, as I recall, in addition, there were German-speaking missions in Zurich, Vienna, and I think Innsbruck. Now there are just 2 missions in Germany and 1 mission for the entire Alpine region. So we're seeing a collapsing of the missions. I could go on and on. I have Germany. I have Scotland. Activity rate is one of the lowest in Europe. The church claims about 26,800 members. The activity rate is around 2,700, so it's around 10%. And they talk about how in the early 80s there were 2 strong wards, then it went to 3 medium wards, now it's back to 2 wards again, and attendance is lower in 2016 than it was in the early 1980s. Sweden, we're so grateful to have Hans and Brigitte Mattsson here and Christina Henke, how do I pronounce that? Hanke? And others from Sweden. Somebody writes in, our ward is most likely the one that has seen the biggest loss of members over the years. With a total of approximately 140 active members in 2005, a total of 51 members have left over issues regarding the history and cover-up of the church. Most of these are parents and kids are included in the 51 who have left. Today, the ward stands around 50 to 70 people. Morale is low. There's a clear shift taking place. I can go on and on. Ukraine. To date, 2 missions have baptized over 1,500 new members. But since then, the mission is closed. There's a war in Ukraine. No real growth in over a decade. And the second mission in Ukraine was absorbed into Kiev. Finland reports to have around 3,000 members, few of which are remaining active, and there are more people leaving than coming. I can go on and on and on. Russia as well. Netherlands. I won't take the time. Estonia. It says that the church has been in Estonia since 1990 and reportedly has 1,106 members. About 150 are active, as the census showed. But my guess is around 10 to 20 people for the whole country are being baptized each year. So those are some really tough numbers for Europe. How many of you feel that reflects what you see here in Europe within the church? Okay. My goal isn't to depress everybody. My goal isn't to sort of spread doom and gloom. But I think it's important, and it's important for a couple of reasons. So why is Europe important? I was thinking about this. And the analogy that I kind of thought about was the canary in the coal mine. Have you guys ever heard of this analogy? So sometimes in these coal mines, deep down below, toxic gases can build up in the coal mine, right? But you want to find out about that before your mine workers start dying. And so what they do is they bring these canaries down deep into the coal mine, and they just keep them there. And if the canary dies, then they know that the toxic fumes are building up and they've got to do something about that. And it allows them to evacuate the workers in time to be able to make the changes so that they could get the working conditions to be safe again. And I wonder whether Europe sort of represents this sort of dynamic. In other words, is it possible that Europe sort of leads the United States and even the rest of the world in many categories? And so I was thinking about that because, like, 2 of the biggest podcasts that I ever did were Hans and Brigitte Mattsson and Tom Phillips. How many of you listen to those podcasts? They're kind of significant, right? Well, they're both from Europe, right? And so I just went and looked up same-sex marriage. To what extent did Europe sort of, lead the United States in same-sex marriage? And what do you see? You see that Sweden in 2009. You see Spain in 2005. You see Portugal 2010. Norway 2009. Netherlands 2001. Right? Iceland, France, Belgium, Denmark, United Kingdom all beat the United States, right? They're sort of trendsetters for the rest of the world. And it's not just in same-sex marriage. Democracy didn't start in the United States, right? The UK sort of helped set the stage, but France very much helped spread democracy, and we kind of followed. And Europe sort of led the world in abolishing slavery, in the civil rights movements in many ways, in supporting women's suffrage. I noticed that Sweden was one of the first countries to allow women to vote at a local level. And if you look in the 1910s, you see so many European countries popping up before the United States finally allows women to vote. And it's true about same-sex marriage. And so it's really significant that we're having this conference here and that we're talking about Europe, because it's a possibility that what's happening in Europe is a foreshadowing of what is possibly going to happen in the United States. And that really makes me reflect back on my great-grandfather, William Parkinson. Because the vitality of Mormonism, of the Restoration Movement, drew its lifeblood from where? I mean, we all know what happened, right? Like, we started the church, but immediately what did we do? We sent missionaries where? Here. And thousands and tens of thousands of our early church members came from struggling, you know, people who were looking for a better life, kind of immigrants, right? They came to the United States seeking something better. In many ways, they were vulnerable. They were starving for something better. And we brought them here. But I'm really humble about that now, because I'm thinking they were looking to us for the answers. But Europe has a lot of knowledge and wisdom and experience that we should be learning from, right? And so, overall, if you look at sort of the trends from all the emails that I received, there's low activity rates. In some ways, it seems like the leadership is more lenient with the members because they don't want to lose them. But in other ways, it kind of seems like they're clamping down a bit and focusing on obedience. Certainly, the missionary work is receding. They're targeting people from developing countries. And missionaries are having less and less to do. They're closing more missions. And so it makes sense to think about to what extent Europe is sort of possibly an indicator of what's about to face the church back in the United States. And what I wanted to do now is sort of conclude the challenging portion of this presentation, just talking about a few trends that we're noticing that I think are going to really have a significant influence on the church in the coming months and years. So one is the continued and expanded dissemination of information and discussion. We all know that if the church would conceive of an enemy in 2016, it's the internet, right? It's Google. And the past 10 to 15 years have seen an explosion of information and discussion around Mormonism. We all know that on places like Facebook, there are thousands of groups now where all of you who have concerns or doubts or questions can create these private groups, support each other, share information, and help each other. 10 years ago, there were just a couple Mormon-themed podcasts. Now Lindsay herself has two, you know. There's Infants on Thrones and The Thoughtful Faith and Mormon Matters and so many really quality podcasts out there. The market's almost becoming saturated. How many of you have read CES Letter by Jeremy Reynolds? How many of you have perused Mormon Think and learned about that there? Those assets continue to have a very significant impact on the church, especially in English-speaking countries. With Jeremy Reynolds, he's working on translating CES Letter into several languages. We're going to see that in the next month or so. Could that accelerate, non-U.S. Disaffection? It could, right? Fair Mormon is still going strong. But one really interesting dynamic we've seen over the past few years are faithful Mormon scholars like Terrell and Fiona Gibbons and Richard Bushman, We've got Thomas Worthland McConkie down here. I think it's a nephew or great-nephew of Bruce R. McConkie. There's Patrick Mason with his new book, Planted. For the first time, we see Deseret Book actually sponsoring and selling information that, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years ago might issue as communicated. And you have to think about what the impact of that might be. It's not a simple answer. And then it's even been extended more with the gospel topic essays that have now been released in the past few years. And how do we conceive of this openness that the church seems to be supporting? Well, one conception is they're just trying to be more honest and open. And I think even in my most cynical moments, I have to acknowledge that the church is being more open and honest. There are probably lots of motivations for that. There's probably a little ways that they could go. But I think honesty is an important part of what they're doing. But there's also something really important that they're doing. A lot of my friends who remain active and faithful in Mormonism were raised very differently than I was. They weren't raised with the Bruce R. McConkie mentality. They were raised by parents who read Sunstone and Dialogue, who were progressive. And they were taught about Seer Stones and polygamy and polyandry and Mountain Meadows as children. And once they were taught those historical facts as children, but then they were raised with a really good LDS experience, when they heard those topics later in their lives, they're like, oh yeah, my parents told me about that when I was little. That doesn't really affect me. Now that's a very different upbringing than what I had, right? But for these people, they're not going anywhere. And there's a lot of them in the church still. And so there's this notion of inoculation, right? And you have to wonder whether there's something brilliant about the essays and about the church adopting its church curriculum to incorporate this new information from the essays. And that's that we have whole new generations of Seminary Institute students who are going to be hearing about Mountain Meadows and polygamy and peepstones and polyandry, just the right, you know, context, just the right level of information, to make it so that when they're an adult and they stumble upon some of this information, they're going to be like, oh yeah, my seminary teacher taught me about that. It's not a big deal, right? I think that we might underestimate how effective these essays are likely to be for some of our members. But there's a counter to that. And the best analogy I can think of is a European one. We all know about how all roads lead to where? Rome, right? Well, one of the, you know, stories I heard is that while those roads were sort of really crucial in helping Rome be successful, that maybe those roads also helped lead to its downfall. And so I just Googled a little quote about the roads to Rome, and it basically said, since roads can also be used by one's enemies, the state which builds a road should be confident in its abilities to use and defend it successfully against hostile forces. Because just like your roads can help you go attack a neighboring country, how else can those roads be used? Those countries to come back and attack you. How many of you have heard about people stumbling upon these gospel topic essays and it actually leads them to leave the church? Anybody? It's becoming increasingly common. And so we've got these countervailing forces where there's inoculation happening, but there's also infection happening. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see kind of how that plays out. There are a few other really important trends that I think I'll just try and list really quickly. One is just the rise of secularism around the world. You know, you can go to the New York Times and see how Europe is becoming more secular. Here's a quote. In the European Union as a whole, according to a 2010 survey, half the population believes in God, compared with over 90% in the United States. Is that what the United States is headed for? Are we sort of following the same trend as Europe? If you look at religious observance in selected countries, you look at countries like Czech Republic and France and Britain and Belgium and Netherlands, Spain and Israel, you've got close to 50 people who never attend church services. Imagine an entire half your country never attending church services. Is it possible that that's a trend that's going to follow to the United States? Well, we know that that's the direction it seems to be headed. If you look at the Pew Foundation, And their survey of religiosity within the United States, you hear about this group called the Rise of the Nones, N-O-N-E-S. This is people who, when asked what religious group they affiliate with, their answer was what? None. And what we find out is that this is not only the fastest growing religious group in the United States, it's also the largest. It's really hard to have something large also be the fastest growing, if any of you have ever heard of the law of large numbers. Usually small numbers grow fast, but in this case, the largest group is also the fastest growing. And you can see that in the United States overall, those who no longer affiliate with any religious tradition are around 23-24%. That's almost a quarter of the entire population. But what's most alarming is that blue number, right? That blue number represents who? Millennials, people in their 20s and 30s. Their number is at 33% and growing. And so this suggests that the United States, as has been in so many other important social and cultural issues, is following Europe's lead in terms of becoming more secular. So this is a dynamic affecting every religious tradition. And I'm guessing that the Community of Christ would also acknowledge that this is a really significant trend. And it's going to affect all religions, not just Mormonism. This is a really important issue. And Devery mentioned it in his last session a little bit. If you think about how Europe progressed in the 40s and 50s and 60s, right? You know, and I know the politics are difficult to discuss, but you think about it, you know, after World War II, America started rising in popularity. True? Lots of countries were struggling and vulnerable. Well, when does missionary work become effective? When people are vulnerable. So you've got this popular country, right, that's more affluent, going into these, you know, countries all over the world, including Europe, waving that American flag. You've got, you know, all sorts of things that people are paying attention to happening back in the United States. And people are excited to be involved in something related to America, right? You can think about baseball. You know, the baseball baptisms that happened in the UK was because everyone was so excited about American baseball because they were all following it, right? And so as long as America is viewed as popular and good, well, the church is going to do well in its missionary efforts. But what happens when America starts to not be perceived as good, right? How in the heck is this crazy guy about to win the Republican nomination for president? But he is. He's leading in four of the five major polls by double-digit margins. He is going to be the Republican nominee for president, most likely. It's crazy, right? How is that going to affect, you know, we know that George Bush wasn't great on our image, right? And I would guess that Barack Obama's been a slight improvement. But what if we go back to that, right? Think about how that's going to affect the church's influence across the world. When you think about what churches and people want to be known for, I think about these values that we sung about, right? About courage and service and loving everybody. And that's what churches want to be known for, right? They want to be known for being loving and kind and compassionate and serving. Families and inclusion, right? Isn't that what churches want to be about? Think about the press that the LDS Church has received over the past 5 to 10 years. I'll just give you a little help if you can't remember. Okay? Proposition 8, protest targets Mormon Church. These are people standing outside of our temple with signs saying, you know, get the hate out of my state, right? This is associating hate with a religious group. That becomes a problem over time in your public image. Mormons tip scale and ban on gay marriage. Do you know how many people left the church in California when the LDS Church came in and convinced an entire independent democratic state to sort of abolish the rights of people in a sovereign state to marry whom they choose? The church took a huge hit. And you would think, oh, they'll learn from that lesson, right? They're going to change because they got such a black eye. But here we go, the front of the New York Times, you know, newspapers all over the world. The church is excommunicating women who are simply asking the leaders to sort of allow women to have a more prevalent place. This isn't good for the church's image. Church excommunicates intellectuals who ask too many questions, who support LGBT rights, who are advocates for that, right? And then you think, you know, I wake up in October, November thinking, there's no way it could get worse. There's absolutely no way that the church is, they've got to have someone in the PR department saying, all right, guys, we've had this brutal, awful few years of press. It's time to just kind of back off, to let things be chill, and we're going to just stay out of the media for a while, keep it low-key, be about love and kindness and service. You know, and President Packer, candidly, President Packer passes away. And we're all thinking, it's going to be a new church. It's going to be rainbows and butterflies and jelly beans and lollipops, right? That's what's going to happen. But what happens is the church makes this crazy policy decision, right? Where not only is it going to make, you know, same-sex marriage immediate grounds for apostasy, but they're going to prevent the children of those who are, you know, children of a same-sex marriage from being members until they're 18, and they can only join when they're 18 if they do what? If they explicitly denounce the chosen lifestyle of their parents. If I were writing a fictional anti-Mormon novel, I couldn't write this stuff, right? You couldn't write this stuff. It wouldn't be believable. And it just keeps getting worse. The church opposes medical marijuana, and you have all these sick people saying how important medical marijuana is to them to sort of be able to live a healthy, natural life. The church opposes it. Utah tries to pass hate crimes legislation. You know, finally, the Utah Senate, apparently over the past week, I haven't been there, but they've sort of overridden the church's denunciation of the hate crimes bill, and they're going to pass it. And my point is, it's been an awful 10 years for the church in terms of public relations. And what's crazy is, you'd think they'd learn and would make it better. But the trend is they're actually making worse decisions over time. And that's really hard to understand. Another hugely important socioeconomic dynamic is the rise of previously disenfranchised groups. We all know it. It's all over Europe, right? Women are on the rise. People of color are on the rise. LGBT individuals are on the rise. And basically, American influence is in decline, but what does that mean? That means the influence of other countries is on the rise, right? So if you're a religion that's hooked yourself to the subjugation of women, the subjugation of people of color, the subjugation of LGBT people, and all those people are on the rise, what is your future going to look like, especially with the younger generations? Does that make sense? You're on the wrong side of history. And you don't want to be on the wrong side of history if you want to have success. The last thing I'll just, you know, talk about briefly is priorities. I've talked briefly about this policy around apostasy, right? And we know that, you know, in November they added a little line in apostasy saying that somebody who's in a same-gender marriage automatically qualifies for apostasy. And you just think about priorities for a second. Let's think about all the activities that are not grounds for immediate apostasy. And what are they? You can sexually abuse a child, and you're not automatically an apostate. You can engage in sex trafficking. You can abuse a spouse. You can defraud people of millions of dollars. You can murder people. You can rape people. And you can engage in random illicit sexual escapades, and you aren't necessarily in trouble. Behaviors that are grounds for immediate apostasy. Speaking openly about your doubts and disbeliefs. Asking prophets to prophesy, seers to see, and revelators to reveal. Choosing committed long-term love, and following Doctrine and Covenants 132. Right? Those things are grounds for immediate apostasy. One of the saddest things that I witness as a mental health professional is the irony of how the church stands up for families, right? And says it's an advocate of families. But how in reality, what the church teaches ends up, for many, tearing the family apart. And whether that involves these teachings that only families intact go to the celestial kingdom, that leaves out so many people, right? So many families have kids who leave the church, and then there's, you know, 99.95% of the world's population that aren't sealed in the temple. So we're, you know, we think we're about uniting families, but so many families are left behind in that equation. But what's even more difficult is when I see a person leave the church and their family's reaction to that is to view that person as a disappointment. And that's the most heartbreaking thing of all, because this, you can think about a couple who is raising beautiful children. They're successful in their career. They're contributing to their community. I even like to say that they could cure cancer and they would be a disappointment to their parents for leaving the church. And it's heartbreaking. We've, you know, you guys all know that the church is making significant investments in commercial ventures. $1.5 billion in a mall. The church is now the largest private landowner in the state of Florida. The church is now building huge commercial real estate and residential developments across Utah and in other places. This is understandable because when revenue is in decline from tithing, you have to make that up. And so they have to make these investments to be able to keep the church sustainable. That's just a reality. And so you think about all the different things you want a church to be known for. You don't want your church to be viewed as anti-information, anti-science, anti-progress, anti-families, anti-children, anti-minorities, pro-wealth, and pro-power. Now, I'm not saying that is what the church truly stands for. What I'm saying is that's the perception of many people now towards the church. And so that leaves people with so many different directions to go. Many go to Facebook and find community and support there. There's a new website called Mormon Spectrum that I recommend you guys all look at. What Mormon Spectrum has is a map of all the support groups throughout the world that people can join to get face-to-face local support. There are all sorts of those communities in the United States, but there are relatively few in Europe. And I have to think that there's more need of support in Europe. Secular communities are on the rise. Sunday Assembly started in Logan, in London. Maybe some of you have heard of it, where they have church services on Sunday, but it's sort of a secular congregation. There's another organization called Oasis that started something very similar in the United States. This is allowing people who still want the benefits of community to still be able to participate in that without the dogma, without the baggage, so to speak. And then from the other side, the church is getting hit with fundamentalist alternatives. Denver Snuffer, Julie Rowe, Rock Waterman, the Bundy brothers. These are all sort of peeling off members from the right, just as progressives are peeling off members from the left. And to be honestly, there's a very significant trend, I think, starting in the United States, where progressive Mormons, and in Europe, where progressive Mormons who aren't finding a spiritual home in the LDS Church are finding the community of Christ as an alternative. I was at the wonderful benefit of interviewing Stephen Veazey on Mormon Stories and finding him to be just a beautiful, delightful human being. And I just have to say, there's so much that we can learn from Community of Christ. They haven't asked me to give them any sort of plug, but I've been watching them for many years. They struggled with many of the same issues that the modern LDS Church is struggling with, starting back in the 50s and 60s. And the way that they handled that, I believe, is very noteworthy. They basically said, we have to own up to the history. We realize that this is going to cause a problem. We have to own up to the inequalities. We know that we're going to suffer by owning up to these inequalities. But they did the courageous thing, that very Mormon courageous thing of making those changes, even if they were to face dire consequences as a result. And what's emerged is something that I think is very beautiful. They have sort of these enduring principles around grace and generosity, peace, diversity, community, the worth of all persons, continuing revelation. I can't tell you how beautiful their Doctrine and Covenants is. You read things like their interpretation of Scripture and how they just acknowledge in Scripture that Scripture is flawed. They acknowledge in their Scripture that Scripture is a product of context and of human weaknesses, and that no Scripture should ever be used to subjugate people on the base of race or gender or other sorts of factors. And it's not inerrant. So we've been talking about some very heavy things. I know that. And I want to end with a little bit of hope. Because for me, I hope you can see that even though this is hard, I'm not discouraged. I'm very excited for the future ahead. Not just for myself and my family, but for our people, for our religious tradition. One really easy sort of way to sort of express hope is to look at the Catholic Church. If any of you have seen the movie Spotlight, we know that there are parishes where 6% of the priests were sexually molesting children, systematically. And the Catholic Church survives. Those who want to think that religion is sort of going away, I think are acting prematurely. Religions are going to keep surviving. So where can we find the strength to carry on? And I'm going to sort of tell you where I think the strength lies. I believe that the strength of the future of religion and of non-religion of humanity lies in one word, intimacy. Okay? And this is what I believe intimacy is. Intimacy is unconditional love. It's basically you saying, I love you no matter what. And I hope you love me no matter what. Let's be vulnerable with each other and share our weaknesses, our frailties. Let's be completely honest and open in this sacred exchange of vulnerability. Let's get to have a deep understanding of each other, right? Where I want to learn from you and you want to learn from me. And together, we understand more about each other. And we're going to develop a meaningful relationship because of that. Once we have that meaningful relationship, we will have a fierce commitment to each other's well-being. And instead of defending our own turf, our job is to defend the other's turf, and they're defending ours. And this is a much more beautiful dynamic than living in this world where we're always protecting what's ours at the expense of others. And let's have healthy boundaries where we're respecting people's decisions. This is the future for everyone who wants to have a healthy, positive, happy life. It basically comes down to two things. Empowering the individual to find what's true and meaningful to them. And then making the decision that regardless of the path that these people on, LDS, Community of Christ, other religious tradition, atheist, agnostic, secular, it doesn't matter. We are going to choose to love and accept these people. That's the future. If you think about that family photo that you saw, if my parents were to think of their success or happiness based on whether or not all their kids remained active and faithful, well, they've got one strike against them, right? So my parents could say we kind of failed because one of our four children has left the church. But it gets a little bit more complicated. This is my sister and her husband, to this day completely devout in the LDS Church. They actually took this family photo in front of the same fireplace that we did several years later. Those are their four beautiful children as youngsters. Those are their four beautiful children as adults. And my sister, believe it or not, actually gave me permission to kind of tell the story. That's my sister and her husband kissing by TBM Orthodox standards, even though these four children were raised devoutly Mormon, served missions, all of them married in the temple. To one degree or another, three of the four would be viewed as failures by that criteria that they have operated under. Their oldest son has left the church and has joined the Eastern Orthodox Church. And their family is super happy and healthy. But for him, he wanted to return to more fundamental Christian roots. The second son is about to get a divorce from his wife. And the third son, as I understand it, his beliefs are sort of no longer really strong. The fourth child, the daughter, she's actually had her first temple marriage and then divorced, but now she's been temple married for her second marriage. But here's the point I'm trying to make. What if my sister isn't a failure? What if my sister and her husband aren't a failure? And what if their children aren't failures and disappointments? Right? What if we considered a different alternative? What if we're all whole? What if everybody in this room is whole? And what if everybody in this room is on a sacred journey to figure out what's right for them, to figure out what's most meaningful? What if we're all going to be okay? And what if we stop dividing ourselves and our perspectives based on faithful, not faithful, believer, not believer, etc.? What if it's time to do away, for good, with demeaning anyone over any of these factors? And what if we lived every day like our loved ones who differ from us are not a disappointment, but instead are on a sacred journey? And that everyone deserves full respect and admiration and support. And so this is my suggestions to myself. This is my suggestions to all of you to consider, and to the LDS Church, Community of Christ, and everyone else who are living these truths better than me. This is the secret sauce of the future of humanity. Love unconditionally instead of conditionally. Focus less on exclusion and more on inclusion. Focus less on finances and more on charity. Minimize the weakening and dividing of families, and instead fight to strengthen families of all kinds at any cost. Focus less on power and control, more on empowering individuals. Transcend national and institutional loyalties. Diversify and empower leadership so that your leadership represents the people that you're leading. And what's the funny thing about these types of teachings? Do they sound familiar? Can you think about anyone who sort of taught these sorts of principles? Why are you laughing? In many ways, these are the principles of the Restoration. And in many ways, these are the teachings that Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad taught, right? We don't have to look outside ourselves to find the inspiration for making these changes. These values are built into all of us right now, right? We have them with us, regardless of where we stand. And so I think back to my great-grandfather, William Brigham Parkinson, and I'm grateful that he made this incredible journey. I think our family's better off. I don't know. And I think about all the people that sort of sacrificed. And what this leads me to want to conclude with is a poem by Carolyn Pearson. She's one of my favorites. Many of you have heard this poem before. But I feel like this poem sort of summarizes how I feel, and sort of a way that we can gain inspiration from our Restoration sort of tradition. So I'm going to leave you with the words of Carolyn Pearson.
My people were Mormon pioneers. Is the blood still good? Truth flew by like a dove and dropped a feather in the west. Where truth flies, you follow if you are a pioneer. I have searched the skies, and now and then another feather has fallen. I have packed the handcart again, packed it with the precious things, and thrown away the rest. I will sing by the fires out there on that uncharted ground, where I am my own captain of tens, where I blow the bugle, bring myself to morning prayer, map out the miles, and never know where or when or if at all I will finally say this is the place. I face the plains on a good day for walking. The sun rises and the mist clears. I will be all right. My people were Mormon pioneers.
It would be easy to get discouraged at this moment. And I just want to tell you, I'm as excited as I've ever been for our people. We've been through some really hard things. We've faced some really hard challenges. But why I'm excited is because I think we know the direction we need to walk. I think we know what the truth is, and I think we know what the answers are for healing and growing. And what's most exciting for me is I think we have within us the values and the character and the ability to make this dream a reality. And I think we're going to do it. And it's going to be hard, but I'm excited to work with all of you to make that happen. And I think we can. So I want to thank Sunstone. I want to thank Community of Christ. Thank all of you for the honor of speaking to you today. And let's do it together. That's my talk. Thank you.
Do about 10 minutes for Q&A, and then we have lunch in the other room. Any questions?
Okay. It's not a question. I just wish I had your compelling speaking ability, but now I know where it comes from. You have karma naturally. Your mother was a farmer. John is one of my favorite people. I asked him if I could give to all of you on his behalf this little toy which is on your pew. It's a Chinese finger trap, and that's what he told us about. Fundamentally, all of us today, in this appeal to work together as one, are stuck in a dilemma. And if we pull, we break. If we relax and work together, we build a future. And I think that's what you just said. And I brought these for you to have a metaphor for them to take with you. And for what it's worth, you're the generation that has to decide whether to react or relax. I'm not. I'm old. I'm only him. But I'm also a psychologist. And we're all in pain at this level. So we better relax. So.
I have a question. So, from a European angle, from a European angle, I think you illustrate very well your family history, collective identity, individual identity, meaning. For many Europeans, though, we have a national identity. We have a collective identity. We don't need to keep that anymore. Once we find out that, we've been lied to, and people have made major decisions in their life, we can go back to our friends, our family, from normal school, from primary school, people that we distanced ourselves because they weren't the same as us. But actually, they're really nice. You have the geographic definition, the ancient motor myth. You have all those classical things which we associate with national identities, which are based on Utah. Do you not think that there's a reason why there's not been more support groups in Europe? We have an alternative. But not
really. One of the things that inspired me by Stephen Beasley was him. First of all, I haven't rejoined the religious tradition. I don't think that has to be the answer. I don't think post-Mormonism has to be the answer. I think everyone's got to find what works for them. And I think tapping into your historic identity is a really powerful way to get to understand and to develop resiliency and strength in community. So I love all that. I love the lesson that I learned from Steve Beasley when he talks about all the people of color, the women, the various nationalities that they include in their Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And when I spoke to him about that, there was a real power in what he was saying. He's like, if we're going to lead these people, we're going to be stronger if they're leading alongside with us. And that's a commitment that Community of Christ has made. And I think that's what we need as a global commitment. We need everybody's input. I really love something Lindsay says. We need a theology from the margins. We no longer need countries from afar telling us how to live. We need to tap into local resources, local strengths, and the beautiful diversity of our world to empower us and strengthen us. And so I see it as really exciting that the things you talked about. What's your name?
Gary,
yeah. And so I think that this moves us closer towards a vision that's healthier and stronger. So thank you. Yes?
Yeah, I think it's really Gary. I feel Gary. I feel that we have been in church in Utah, and then at lots of church. I see so many friends in Utah that And the thing is, Mormon culture is American culture. And we grew up with that. I knew how to cook brownies when I was 9 years old. The whole Americanism of my life. And I'm now feeling like I've lost that. But I don't know how to be. Maybe there's something wrong with me, but I don't know how to be Scottish or English without Mormonism and the American culture. Yet I see within the meantime, how this people are able to go to similar churches or communities where the culture that I identify with is still there. So in many ways, I think it's harder for us because I feel I've been completely off the drift.
Yeah. I have to say, recently Hans was featured in a little 30-minute podcast in the United States from a podcast called Reply All. And he makes this beautiful metaphor. First he talks about being on a ride at Disneyland and how it was beautiful while the lights were off, but as soon as the lights turned on, how everybody realized that it wasn't, you know, what it felt like, right? But then he talks about how scared it is to be lost. But how beautiful it is to be lost. Because once you're lost, you now get to go on the exciting journey of finding yourself. And it's scary, and it's hard, and you're going to mourn it like the death of a parent or a child. And that's okay. Embrace that. Cry about it. Weep and wail and gnash your teeth about it. Give yourself time to be depressed about it. And the only thing I'm going to offer to you is, on the other side of all that very important work, it's the best time ever to be in the position you're in. You can find support communities. You can find online communities. You can tap back into your natural heritage. You've got so many resources available to you to become found, to find what it is that you want to be. And it's scary. It's like Adam and Eve being cast out of the Garden of Eden, naked, with thorns and thistles and noxious weeds. It's happening all over again. But something makes me feel like they were glad that they got cast out of that boring garden, right? Because they got to actually live life awake and alert for the first time. And so I validate your sadness and mourning, but I also want to promise you that if you can sort of make it through that and sort of maintain some hope and optimism, there will be resources all around you to help you find that happy, joyful, meaningful life. And we're committed, Sunstone's committed, Community of Christ is committed. All of us are committed to helping you through that transition. So you're not alone. We'll help you. Okay? Okay. Yes?
Hi, I'm Deborah. I run the UK Former LDS group in the UK. And John, I'm so grateful for you coming over here today because my husband and I took part in your survey back in 2011. And we left because of history, but we have a rich heritage from the church as well. Our children left before us. And they were like, we told you all this. But it is hard to sit in the church and have those three empty spaces. We grieved for many years. We was like, I thought we'd never have our children together again. We'd be together forever. Which was actually not right at all. And when we made that decision to move away from that kind of belief, we brought our families so much closer together. And within the UK, so that the southwest of England, also there's a Bloor effect. And Stephen Bloor was the first person that we turned to for advice when he left the church. Or at least he was actually questioning or guiding people not to leave him. And he's had a ripple effect amongst many of our members as well. And a lot of people are transitioning away from the church very quietly, so a bit more outspoken. But I think that heritage thing, lots of us were brought up in the church in the 60s and 70s, and that American, it's like a mini Utah in every chapel. It really was like that. So it was very much trying to get back to our roots as well, and getting out there and finding people. And the events like this is a really good idea to share those experiences as well. And life is brighter. Life is so much brighter for us. I mean, all those principles you spoke to, what my parents taught me anyway, I was raised Catholic, they were nothing new, but now they feel doable. Without any kind of aims for reward or celestial glory, it's for the sake of humanity. And I really appreciate what you've shared with us today.
Thank you, Deborah. My question's related to family. If you really hit home with some of the pictures of your family, you might have read it. So I can imagine that's where my parents are. I love the church, my brother loves the church. So do you have any tips on sort of breaking the cycle of orthodoxy and trying to get them to the place where you sort of conclude?
Yes, I do.
Give it to me.
I do. What is it that you want? You want them to love and accept you unconditionally. Right?
Yeah.
But you can't expect that from them if you're not willing to offer that back to them. And so I'll tell you, number one, your goal is not to extricate them from the church. Your goal is not to take away their sacred beliefs. And not only is it just not a nice thing to do, it turns out psychologically that when you try and push somebody in the direction, what do they naturally do? They push back. Exactly. Just like Brother Osmond helped share with us, right? The harder you pull, the harder grip these things hold on to you. And so, ironically, if your goal is for your family to leave the church, the most important thing you can do is never talk to them about the church, right? What you do is you find a support group of people you can vent to, you can get validation from, you can get support from, and you're going to build up new authentic relationships based on vulnerability, right? And genuine intimacy. And that's going to help, while you're mourning, fill the holes that are in you because you've lost some of that deeper connection with your family. And so many people were the good son or the good daughter, and now they've sort of been demoted, right? And it's heartbreaking. You have to do the psychological work to get over that. It's kind of prideful anyway. But more importantly, when you just start living this happy, healthy life, and you're never talking about it, that creates a space for them to actually come to you. At some point, maybe it's in 5 months, maybe it's in 6 months, maybe it's in a year, maybe it's in 5 years, where they're like, wow, you guys seem really happy. What happened? And you know what the best response is? I don't want to talk about it. It's okay. I really respect your views, and we're super happy, and I never want to do anything to hurt your views. You know what that's going to make them do? What's it going to make them do? They're going to be more interested. Now, again, the goal isn't to get them out, right? But I'm just telling you psychologically, you have to create that space for them to walk into it, or you're going to create resistance and push them away. And over time, when you diminish the need for their approval, right, because you're becoming more of an adult, more mature, when you have a healthy support system, you need their approval less. And then you've created that space so that when they're ready, when they're interested, and maybe they never will be, but maybe they will. And the only way they will is when you create that space to let them come ask you. And you make them beg you before you ever tell them anything, right? But when you feel like they really want to know and they're really ready, then you share vulnerably. And you're open to whatever happens to them. But remember, your goal isn't to change them. Your goal is to change yourself. Because you want to model the respect that you want from them. Does that make sense? It's very pithy, but that's kind of my
last question.
So, is two quick questions? Okay.
Okay. I'm in a great position. I joined the church in the in the Netherlands. I was working abroad and I just got curious. I felt quite lucky in that I knew about all the controversial things before I joined. I joined with open eyes, and the first thing I said to the sister missionaries I invited via the website to my house was, I'm not joining it if I can't be a feminist. So just, you know, let's talk about how we can make this work. But it is strange as an older woman. I mean, I'm not an older woman. I'm 31 now, which isn't old by any stretch of the imagination. But within LDS communities, and a 31-year-old and married convert woman living in the north of England, it's very strange and very lonely. But I'm just sort of, I joined the church because I felt this deep resonance of truth that I couldn't turn away from. And I still feel that. And despite the crap that happened, you know, the two shots to my heart, I think, were the Kate Kelly excommunication. Because I couldn't understand why you would excommunicate someone for asking questions. Yours as well, but once, because it was after Kate, I almost wasn't surprised. And then this thing with the under-18s, of, you know, children of gay parents, what the hell is going on? Because, I mean, in America, obviously, you've only just got legal gay marriage across the country, but we've had civil partnerships recognised in the UK since 2004. So, you know, children of those marriages, we've had a whole generation now to deal with it. You know, Mormon communities, children who probably have gone on missions, who have accepted the ambiguous messages and still have been okay. So that was very shocking to me. But really, I'd like to advise on living as a quirky woman, I guess. It's sometimes I sit and I look at Utah and I know that it's awful in all kinds of ways for people who don't fit there. But I feel like I don't fit here either because, I mean, this is the most LDS people I've ever seen, or linked people I've ever seen in a room. Our congregation is half the size of this. And then a lot of them are just, you know, lots of local families. Whereas I feel like just me. So how do you build a community and live your own faith as a Christian woman, I guess, as in a country and a culture that doesn't, where you really don't fit?
Yeah. Wow, how do I answer that, right? What I can say is I understand. I would not have left the church if they hadn't excommunicated me. I didn't want to go. So I resonate with your desire to stay affiliated, and I support it. I celebrate it. I think that I want to see the LDS church become super healthy, and all churches become healthy. And I want to validate that desire in you to stick with it. I don't have any easy answers, especially in a minute or two. There are a lot of resources. I don't know if Mormon Matters podcast is useful to you or Thoughtful Faith podcast. There are a lot of books that are helpful. I think, you know, if you can find community of people, you know, through Mormon Spectrum,
yeah.
If you can just become a little leader where you can find the quirky Mormons, there are more quirky Mormons around the UK. And if you can sort of create a little group together, you guys can start supporting each other. There's going to be a lot of patience. It's going to take patience, right? But I would say follow your heart. Get to know yourself, and you'll find what's right for you over time. And that sounds cheesy, it sounds simplistic, but I believe in that. And you'll know what direction to go. You just have to tap inside. It sounds simplistic, but I believe it. We can talk more. Last question.
Okay, it sort of circles back to the question previous to this. And I actually followed the model of, this is my story to tell, but I would have to share it with you, and I'm not going to push it on anybody. But I got to a point where it was sort of a demand from particular. How did you get to this point? Tell me what happened. How did this come about? And I find the references when I did write the letter. I listened to a number of your talks on the very subject, right, with my law principles, and went, well, they are coming for a visit next month. How do you advise when someone demands? How did you get here? What happened? You know, demanding the story of you, which is your story to tell, and yet it's people you want a relationship with, people you want to.
So the question is, well, how do you respond to family who's demanding to know your story? And are you saying you're not comfortable sharing it, or you're worried that if you share it, something might go wrong?
Yes, and there are certain parts. I mean, they're about 80, and it's not, this is something that I don't have any desire to take them away from that part of their life. I mean, and yes, I do want their unconditional love and acceptance. I don't, but in order for them to fully understand my position, they would have to ask some very, very hard questions that I'm not sure that they really want to deep down inside. I mean, the ultimate goal, I think, is to figure out how it went wrong and how they can fix it. I believe that's their perspective. And so I'm trying to, I guess, maybe take back that narrative and do it in a respectful way. But I feel like, you know, when I'm put on the spot, I have to say something.
I'd say there's a couple approaches you could take in that situation. One is to refer them to reading materials or to podcasts. You can say, listen, I don't ever want to hurt you, I don't want our relationship to be damaged, I value that above all else. Here's a book I'd like you to read. And we can give you ideas on books, you may have some. Here's a podcast I'd like you, if you want to understand me, listen to this podcast. Read this book, read these materials. And that avoids kind of interpersonal conflict. You can always write them a letter and allow them to process it when you guys aren't in the room. Because obviously when you start triggering each other, you get this fight or flight response where your IQ actually drops between 10 and 30 points when you're activated. And so allowing them to process the information through a letter, through a book, while you're not in the room, gives them time to process it, to get emotional, to cool down, and then you can have that conversation maybe at a later date. I do recommend minimizing the details. You can speak in general terms, but you can also be really reassuring of their values. You can just say, I don't want to talk to you about this because I respect your beliefs, and I never want you to change, ever. And so I'll tell you just a little bit, but it's going to be vague in general, because I want you to know that I never want you to change. I love you exactly for who you are. And there's only one thing I ask in return if we have this conversation. And what's that? And you get that promise. I'll say, I'll have this conversation with you if you promise that we are going to love each other unconditionally when it's done. And make sure they commit. Make them sign a piece of paper, right? I feel like I'm giving really pithy answers, but it's the best I can do in just a few minutes' time. If any of you guys need help, email, Skype, there are lots of good resources out there. We'd love to help in any way we can. Sunstone is going to be coming back every year. They're going to be doing a Sunstone next year, probably in Germany, whatever country wants to host.
Let's go crazy.
Support Sunstone, and you'll get more and more support out here that you need. I'm sorry for time. Thank you, Sunstone. Thank you, Community Press. Thank you all.
Die Musik für diesen Audiobeitrag wird zur Verfügung gestellt durch Ben Howington von Mormon Guitar. Besuche seine Webseite unter www.mormonguitar.com.